Those earth creatures always shooting off their mouths.
Gonna step up to the microphone.
PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to The Bunker, one day away from the Ides of March.
Otherwise known as Mom's Birthday.
That's right. That's what we think of around
it's
here.
Not nearly as ominous as the Ides of March.
It's Et Tu Birthday?
That's right. That's a good one.
Thanks, Ed. And of course, on Friday, one of my favorite holidays, St. Patty's Day.
Yeah, you know, somehow, having read a little bit of the life of St. Patrick and a little bit of that era of history in which he lived, post-Roman Britain, I somehow think he would not have approved of the way most of us Americans choose to celebrate the day named after him.
I think green beer and big balloons, that's just probably not what he had in mind.
No, I don't think so.
Well, actually, over in Ireland, it's becoming a little more commercial, but traditionally it's been a very religious holiday.
The group that I sang with for many years here in St. Louis, the Ambassadors of Harmony Barbershop Chorus, traveled to Ireland a few years back and participated in some of the St. Patrick's Day festivities there, and were surprised to find out that it's not as big a deal in Ireland as it is here in the United States. And they were told by their Irish hosts, we're starting to get into the swing of it. You know, it's not exactly as the way he said it, but basically they only do it for the American tourists, so.
Well, maybe next year, March 17th of 2007, we can celebrate in Ireland with Paddy Heron.
There we go. Have some of that black beer and listen to him sing in the pub.
There you go.
He's threatened us with that, so we may take him up on it. Well, and we will be hearing from Paddy this week, by the way. We'll tell you a little bit more about that in a little bit as we get down to business here just after 7 o'clock Bunker Standard Time. Of course, that's 0100 Greenwich Mean. And we've got part one of our interview with Tom Horn of Raiders News Update coming up in just a little bit to talk about Dominionism. What is Dominionism? Why is it bad?
That's a good question. You know, Tom Horn is guesting on the Q Files this week, and he's doing a great job.
He really is. He had a fascinating interview tonight, Tuesday evening. He interviewed Jim Wilhelmson of Roswell, New Mexico. He runs a shop there called
Roswell.
Echoes of
Roswell.
Enoch. A little X Files reference there for you. And he's written a book called Beyond Science Fiction, which I think is what most people think of when they look at how we view the UFO phenomenon and how it ties into reality as we see it, reality as we think it's laid out in the Bible. So we'll be on tomorrow night, and we're going to talk a little bit about ancient Egypt, ancient Babylon, ancient Sumeria, ancient Israel.
A lot of
ancient stuff, and how it relates and impacts us today and the future.
And because that's where we're
suspend the rest of our lives.
You know, we didn't get to hear all of tonight's Q Files with Tom Horn, so I'm going to have to listen to it on the archives tomorrow. If you miss any of those shows, you can join the archives. It's a nominal fee of $6.95 a month. We've been paying that fee for a couple of years now because it is so worth it to us. Sometimes when we have a job to do here in the bunker, we will just crank that up and listen to show after show after show while we're painting walls or cleaning or whatever.
Yeah, Steve Quayle has written some fascinating books on the giants of Genesis 6 and how it relates to today and prophecy, and he's done just an amazing amount of research. I mean, if you think that the Nephilim, that is just a fable, that the giants of Genesis 6 are a tall tale told by the Hebrews to scare their kids, you just need to look at some of the pictures on Steve's site of people today, alive today, who are 8, 9, 10 feet tall. So the concept of David meeting a guy who was 12, 13 feet tall is not that out of the question. You see bones of skeletons that must have been in the range of 13 to 15 feet tall. It's not that out of the question. So Steve's got that at his website. It's not something he talks about every night, but it is part of his worldview, and that's why we have been listening to his show from, well, for a couple of years now, several years.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're honored to be on the program tomorrow night, even if we have to talk with Tom Horn instead of Steve.
You know, though, the reason, Tom, if you're listening, and he does tell us he listens to these, Tom, we didn't listen to all of your show tonight live because Derek was on the phone during part of your interview with someone we're going to be talking to this weekend for next week's podcast.
Oh, yeah. Wait till you hear next week. We are going to interview a paranormal investigation team. That is a real hot entertainment form right now on television.
Well, if Ghost you've ever Hunters. Seen, what's the name of the show?
It's
the
one Ghost on Hunters.
Ghost Hunters. Yeah, sorry. I know you just said it, and I just went, I was thinking Taps. No, Taps is, of course, what they call their company. It is about these guys who are plumbers by day and ghost hunters by night, and it is a fascinating show. They come in as skeptics, and oftentimes they leave unconvinced that there's anything paranormal going on. Well, the people we're interviewing this weekend work with these guys.
Right. It's the New England Anomalies Research and Investigations, or they call themselves NEAR, which is two brothers, Keith Johnson and Carl Johnson, and then a team that works with them. What's different, in fact, Keith and Carl are the guys that the TAPS people bring in when they've got a house that needs to be cleared of the entities that are inhabiting it. Mm-hmm. They are the demonologists on call for TAPS. And they do their own investigations. So we just confirmed tonight an interview for Sunday. We'll have that for you next week. And the good thing about these fellows is that when they go into battle, when they go into an investigation, they go in with the full armor of God.
They do. They don't go in with nuclear reactors on their backs.
No.
The way the Ghostbusters.
That's right. They go in with even more power, which is really cool.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, they go in with the same type of electronic gear as the TAPS crew does to try to gather evidence and prove that the paranormal exists, but they know what they're dealing with.
Well, before we got on the subject of TAPS, we were talking about some ancient things.
Right.
And we're going to go to a story, a little segue there, on today's WatcherMagazine.com. Archaeologists find ancient Israel tunnels that date back 2,000 years.
Yeah, this is from a village in northern Israel. They found tunnels that date back to the Jewish War, the revolt against Rome that took place between the years of 66 and 70. And, of course, that's when the Roman general Titus came in and leveled most of Judea. But it's when Jerusalem fell, which, of course, was prophesied by Jesus in the Olivet Discourse.
Right, when he said that the temple would fall and not one stone would be left upon another.
Which, of course, when the gold in the temple furnishings melted, it ran in between the cracks of the stone, so the Roman soldiers...
Or at least that's what the soldiers were told, and they believed that. Now, whether or not it was true or not, but that's what...
Yeah, so the stones were pried apart. But what was interesting is that, of course, Jesus prophesied, and like many prophecies in Scripture, they have multiple fulfillments. And he said that as a warning that when people saw the abomination that causes desolation, which, of course, was a reference back to Daniel's prophecy, which was fulfilled when Antiochus Epiphanes, about 150 B.C., set up an altar to Zeus inside the temple.
Yeah, sacrificed a pig.
And sacrificed a pig in there, which, of course, is,
that's bad. So unclean.
Yeah.
And rude.
Well, the Christians living in Jerusalem at the time of the Roman attack in 70 interpreted Jesus' prophecy as meaning it's time to get out of Jerusalem. And so they lit out for the hills before the legions had it completely encircled. Mm-hmm. And so the small Christian community in Jerusalem actually was able to survive the destruction of Jerusalem, where many of the residents were slaughtered when the Roman legions finally broke through the walls.
You know, I'm wondering right now, and you would know this better than I, because you know your history better than I when it comes to first century. Paul wrote his letter to the Thessalonians who were asking, did we miss the rapture? And was it about this time or shortly after this? Because, you know, if this event happened and you believe that this is something that was going to happen in the middle of the tribulation week, you would think you may have missed something.
No, that was about 20 years earlier. Paul died. Paul was martyred a couple of years before the legions took Jerusalem.
Oh, that's right.
James, the brother of Jesus, was also martyred in the year 62. which conveniently took place in an interim period. You know, Felix, who was the governor of...
Right, I do remember that.
Right, and Paul...
He spoke to Felix, and Felix was almost persuaded.
Right, and then not quite. Well, yeah. Felix died.
One of the saddest sentences in all of the Bible.
Yeah.
Almost thou dost persuadest me.
Yeah, yeah. But in the year 62, Felix finally passed away, and... The Jews, although they were in charge of religion there, they were not allowed to pass judgment and execute prisoners, which is why they had to go to Pontius Pilate to get Jesus crucified.
Right.
Well, in the interim period, while a new governor was being sent from Rome, the high priest of Jerusalem then took Jesus' brother, or half-brother, James, and just had him executed while he was kind of in between governors, while they were in between governors in Judea. So that's how they managed to get that through. But again, it was just a couple of years later that Jerusalem was destroyed.
See, I knew you would know that because you taught a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I so respect you. You got to know, folks, that my husband did not grow up studying this stuff.
No.
I did. I mean, from the time I was probably 8, 9 years old, I was you know, in a church setting where we were studying prophecy and studying the books of the Bible from very, you know, basic all the way up to really advanced stuff. And you were lucky if you got, you know, Noah and Abraham and things like that.
Yeah, Paul and Silas singing in the jail cell.
You know, you have just gotten in there and you dig and dig and dig, and you really, really have become quite a scholar over
the
last
I don't know
few
about
years.
That,
that's why I knew when I asked that question that you would have the answer.
Well, thank you, sweetheart. But it was part of trying to figure out what it was I believed. And for some people, like you, you just had an instinctive knowledge.
I've
you knew.
Since I was probably 2.
Right.
3. It's my earliest memory.
I came in it from a very skeptical perspective. You know, I was indoctrinated, I suppose, with the naturalistic worldview that science can explain everything. And we're here because we evolved from lower life forms. We had a real, we had a very heated discussion early in our marriage, folks, about how Christians could believe in evolution and accept that mankind evolved from microbes. You know, rock plus water plus billions of years equals you was the basic formula. And it took evidence like the martyrdom of James. Because as I said in yesterday's program, I love my little sister. But it would take an awful lot to convince me to the point that I would die before deny that she was God in the flesh. And as the Apostle John recorded in his gospel, James and the other brothers of Jesus, including Jude, who was also martyred, did not believe in him during his ministry, but something changed their minds. That was very persuasive to me. Because, again, the martyrdom of James is not recorded in the Bible. It's recorded by Josephus, the Jewish historian, who was a Pharisee and had nothing to gain by promoting Christianity.
Yeah, so, that's a good point.
Anyway, we've kind of gotten the feel, but it is an interesting article, and it showed that the people of Israel at that time were preparing for a long battle with Rome.
Oh, yeah, because these tunnels were used as hideaways.
Yep.
It's really, really interesting.
Interesting glimpse into the past, yeah.
I know. Speaking of things like that, you know, little map-like pictures, Google now has Google Interactive Mars.
Yeah, you know where I went first when I looked?
Where?
Cydonia.
Oh, do they have that?
They have it marked, yeah.
I'm shocked.
You put in Cydonia, it takes you right there. And, of course, just like when you type in, like, the name of a city and they've got all these little markers for points of interest.
Yeah.
You've got markers there to face on Mars. And then another one that says alleged face on Mars. So it's worth a look, and there is a link to it at Watcher Magazine. Well, of course, if you just do mars.google.com, you'll probably turn it up anyway. But it's
probably because they've got an interactive moon map system.
Very
of course,
cool.
Google Earth as well.
Yeah, very cool.
I thought
cool.
That was just the coolest thing. And of course, Google is still sort of wrestling with the government.
Yeah, yeah. The government's ordering Google to turn over information in connection to an investigation into child pornography.
Which sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But, you know, the worry there is that you run afoul of somebody in the government and they accuse you of child pornography in order to access personal information
and data.
And
where do you draw the line? We'd like to see all of your files regarding people who have looked up PID radio.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty far stretch.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to go way left of field.
Okay.
Just way left of field. Something that's not even on WatcherMagazine.com.
Oh, no.
If you can believe that. Can you believe it?
Gasp.
I read a review of a movie, V for Vendetta, which is out in the theaters now. And I guess that movie is really getting a lot of water cooler chat, and even, you know, talk in the press, because it seems to be glorifying a terrorist, you know, making him appear as a Zorro, or better comparison is Phantom of the Opera. And of course, the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera is a very sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing horrible things. He's killing people.
Uh-huh.
But his character is so sympathetic. This is a similar setup. It takes place in a futuristic alternative universe London that has turned into essentially Nazi Germany. And John Hurt is the Hitler type of Big Brother. And this anti-hero wants to blow up a building in London. And I think it's Natalie Portman who's in it with him. I'd have to verify that, but I guess the big buzz is, can you make a hero out of a terrorist who wants to blow up buildings in London? Is that socially acceptable?
Well, sure, why not? If you listen to some of the academics teaching in our college campuses today, the guys who led the American Revolution in the 1770s were terrorists.
Well, yeah, that's true. They are saying that. You got the cutest little smile on your face, little grin.
That's my smirk, yeah. I don't agree with them.
Cheshire cat.
Possessed.
But what I think is so interesting is that, and I think that this is intentional. This is based on a book by the same guy who wrote, and I wish I could think of his name right now. I apologize to you, sir. He wrote the Sean Connery League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh, okay.
And apparently he wasn't happy with how that film turned out, and he's not happy with how this film just turned out based on his work. The idea that you've got a government that has become so invasive in your private life that it's like Nazi Germany at its worst. Everything you want to do is dictated by the government. And this man, almost like a Zorro type, because Zorro was very much like that as well. Supposedly in Zorro, the Spanish government was very oppressive.
Right.
And this government is equally oppressive in this, you know, imaginary London. And this guy, and the reason I say Zorro is because in the previews, at least, I have not seen the movie. I've only read this review. But I have seen the previews. He reminds me of Zorro. He's got a Zorro-type hat on and a mask, which, of course, takes you to the Phantom of the Opera connection. I just found that really an intriguing idea.
I'm looking at the...
If our own government became that dictatorial, at what point do you become... do you say, okay, this is not terrorism, this is patriotism?
Well, that's a good question, and one that Christians need to wrestle with, because some have argued that the leaders of the American Revolution should not have rebelled against the government on the basis of Scripture. Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's." Should George Washington and the other heroes of the American Revolution, heroes from our perspective, have led the revolution, or were they violating Scripture or interpreting Scripture to support what they wanted to do?
Well, let me say this. When the Second Temple was being restored after the Babylonian captivity, they had a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other because they were being invaded constantly. Was it Sennacherib who was constantly sending troops over there to bug them? Somebody was constantly trying to keep the temple from being rebuilt.
I would have to look on that. It might have been some of their neighbors, like the Edomites.
But these guys were fighting the whole time. So I think there are times when it is appropriate. And this is something new for me, because you know that I'm really not for violence very much at all.
Yeah. But I think when you start targeting buildings with innocent people in it, I think clearly that's wrong.
Yeah.
But at what point do you make the judgment that, okay, this is right and this is a righteous rebellion in the eyes of God?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Well, you know, the guy who wrote the review, or at least the article, he asked a good question. He said, if taking down a building is terrorism, then if you knew that Osama bin Laden was in a building alone, is taking down that building terrorism?
Well, that's one to wrestle with.
I know. There's some real gray areas here. But anyway, I thought I'd bring it up. A little food for thought.
Well, that movie opens this weekend, and so we'll clearly take a look at it. I was looking at the official trailer, or the website with the trailer, while we were talking here, and it does look intriguing. So,
it's a very, very interesting-looking movie.
Speaking of interesting movies, we did watch the movie that we mentioned last week over the weekend, The Island.
Oh, it's so good.
Yes, starring Ewan McGregor. And I've not seen a movie with Ewan McGregor yet that's bad. I mean, he is so watchable.
Big Fish, what a great movie.
Big Fish and, well, I don't know, the Star Wars movies. It's not his fault. Liam Neeson is good, too. But Scarlett Johansson was good.
Yeah.
And the... well, the plot
guy
of the movie.
Plays Neelix.
Yeah, the guy Neelix from Star Trek Voyager was in this, and
we don't want to tell you too
role.
Much, but Derek cried too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was crying again. It's such a good movie.
It really is. In fact, Nicole watched it with us, and she brought a friend over from school, and he watched it. And
we were all crying. Well, actually, I think that they knew where it was going because somebody spoiled the end for them.
Yeah.
And we won't
but
do that for you. Just
well worth watching, and it's very thought provoking, and it's amazing that they could do a thought provoking movie with some kicking action scenes in it, and do it without getting into a lot of bad language, and no overt sexual.
Oh, it's amazing!
Overtone. So it's really extremely well done. Steve Buscemi, one of our favorite actors, is also in it. A great character actor.
Yeah.
So yeah, all the way around, an excellent movie. We highly recommend it, but we can't tell you more because we'll ruin it.
Yeah.
So, speaking of movies, one other this is one we're going to have to watch so that we can throw bricks at the TV while we're watching the DVD. What the bleep do we know?
This is a movie that we've talked about that before a long time ago.
It was put out about 2 years ago. Stars Marlee Matlin as a photographer who's got a dim view of life until she learns to love herself. And essentially, the message of the movie is that you can change reality with your mind. And they do this by showing photographs taken by a doctor of alternative medicine in Japan who tries to demonstrate with his photos that if you think real hard at water while it's freezing in a glass, you can change the shape of the crystals. If you think happy thoughts, you get pretty crystals. If you think bad thoughts, you get ugly, misshapen crystals. And therefore,
if you think funny thoughts, you get Billy Crystal.
Yeah, there you go. That's you caught on very quickly. And since humans are mostly water, so the theory goes, if you think happy thoughts about yourself, you'll, you know, be healthy and happy and, you know, health, wealthy and wise and all of that. And the movie has been re-released now, or a follow-up. It's an expanded version, basically. What the Bleep Down the Rabbit Hole is the new version, which has just been released. And the movie has just finished up a 2-month run in New York. It's going to be shown in May at the Quest for Global Healing Conference. Walter Cronkite is going to attend. Desmond Tutu is going to attend. This is becoming a big deal, and I bring it up because we need to be aware of this, because this kind of New Age glop is catching on with a lot of people. And what it's trying to do is meld physics and religion. And that's what we were talking about yesterday with Gorbachev and the Gorbachev Foundation and his connections to the Esalen group and S. Werner Erhard and S. out there in California.
Right.
All of those thinkers. And they're trying to show that science and thinking, and you're all connected. It's the great oneness, and we're all, and ye shall be as gods. is what it boils down to.
Now, pass the plate.
It's what it all comes back to, that same lie from the serpent back in the garden.
Oh, my goodness. So. You know what? We could blather on and on and on and on.
Yep.
But you know what? The other day, Derek did a fabulous interview with Mr. Tom Horn, and we were just talking about him earlier, and sadly, I was asleep.
Well.
So I will be she not appearing in this interview.
That's right.
But we don't want to delay any longer. Here's part one of Derek's interview with Tom Horn.
We're pleased to welcome back to our guest line Tom Horn, the publisher of Raiders News Update and co-author with his wife Nita of The Ahriman Gate. Tom, welcome back to PID Radio.
Hey, Derek, thanks for inviting me back on your show.
Sorry that Sharon's not here. She's the other half of my brain, so you'll have to work with me here tonight.
I understand completely.
Well, you raised a topic during an interview with Steve Quayle on the Q-Files radio broadcast a couple of weeks back that attracted attention from regulars on our forum, and I know that you probably got a lot of feedback from this as well, and that was the subject of dominionism within the body of Christ, Christian dominionism, and how it's going to affect the perception of the end times, the coming disclosure event.
Right.
Boy, that was really something that really got my attention when we listened to it that night also, and so we're really glad that you're here to kind of go through the topic a little bit more. First of all, just to lay the groundwork, what is dominionism?
You know, just in the most basic definition, dominionism is the idea that we as Christians can, through the legal system and legislation, political maneuvering, we can reclaim the dominion that we lost in the Garden of Eden. We can take control of the political systems of the earth. We can therefore implant the morality of God in the hearts and minds of men through legal enforcement. And we can become the custodians of the earth that God wanted us to be in the book of Genesis, and that we can perfect the earth and therefore present it to Christ as having been reclaimed and perfected, and then therefore Christ can return. I mean, that's, in a nutshell, when you're dominionism, as we'll discover tonight, and we talk more about the deeper parts of this subject, is significantly more complex than that. But in a nutshell, the whole idea is to take control, to take it back from the evil people who run our courts and legislative systems and congressional halls, and to perfect it so that Christ can return.
Now, that's really a hot topic right now because, as you know, a lot of prominent Christian pastors are getting involved in the political process. Rod Parsley, in particular, in Ohio. And, well, all over the country, Christians are being encouraged to get back involved in the political process, to vote the right way, to encourage their representatives to push for the right types of judicial candidates at the Supreme Court level and all through the court system. What's wrong with that idea? What's wrong with the idea of trying to, let's say, maybe not impose is the right word, but to vote the way we think Jesus would want us to vote?
Well, look, there's nothing wrong with voting the way we think Jesus would want us to vote.
Okay.
And I said on the program that kind of started this last week when I was on with Steve Quayle, and by the way, we weren't even talking about dominionism. We were talking about dual covenant theology because of the news story in the Jerusalem Post where they were quoting where they said they were quoting Hagee and Rabbi Sheinberg,
right,
and that whole story about Jerry Falwell,
mm-hmm,
converting to dual covenant theology, which both of them by nightfall, you know, were getting any microphone they could to say not true, we didn't say it, and you know, it's like anything else. Today's news is tomorrow's old news. I mean,
right,
the story came and went, but if it served a purpose, it at least raised some significant issues, I think,
mm-hmm,
for the church to consider doctrine that are firmly entrenched in the church now, in particular dominionism,
right,
which in my mind is heretical. And of course, tonight I want to explain why. But I also said on that program that by bringing up the issue of dominionism, I was not saying that there's anything wrong with a Christian voting for what they believe to be morally right, or voting against things that they believe to be against biblical ethics. And furthermore, there's nothing wrong with Christians being political activists. If that's, I would suppose some people may be given, you know, a particular calling, a gift, to be able to be involved in the political sphere. But that's completely different than selling the church on the idea that to be good stewards of our time on earth, that we're actually holding up the return of Christ by not seizing control of earthly power in order to implement the morals and values, to impose them, if you will, on people, to make them live by whatever standards we deem are those that are in line with the will of God. And I have to tell you that, you know, all of this began for me a long time ago in the 80s. I hadn't even really thought that much about it lately, because you know, I started out preaching about and then yelling about and then screaming about the whole thing, you know, that I thought was a problem with dominionism back in the 80s, and it seemed to just consistently fall on deaf ears and wasn't doing anything more than making people mad at me. And so, you know, and so I finally just let it go. But it was my belief that dominionism would become a dominant evangelical heresy that in my mind would undoubtedly lead untold numbers of believers into a false gospel, and frankly provide the doormat for the appearing of the Antichrist. Well, I have to tell you, I believe that more now than I've ever believed it before. Back then, you know, the leaders of the church, the bobbleheads and the entertainment figures and the media elite, they were actually, they started out talking about, and you might remember this, they started out talking about what was called kingdom age theology. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. That was in my nominal Christian phase when I was working in top 40 radio playing music that I prefer my daughter not listen to now. Sharon would remember that, though. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Kingdom Age theology, it was just kind of the early precursor to the broader, what became the Reconstructionist movement, and then now, of course, what's more commonly thought of as Dominionist theology. And most of the people that I hung around with back then in the early days when we were talking about Kingdom Age theology weren't paying that much attention to it. It just seemed to be part of the name it and claim it crowd, and the people that I hung out with, you know, they just would kind of smile, you know what I mean, and look the other way. But then, and I guess, Derek, because of human nature, a large number of believers just started buying into those ideas and those ideologically driven, politically driven pulpiteers. Man, I mean, we started seeing mainstream churches mobilizing adherents to become more and more politically involved. And sadly, along the way, and this was what I guess hurt me, as they became more and more politically involved, they became less and less interested in quiet devotion and their spiritual habits and spiritual life. And the whole thing in the church started turning. I mean, it started becoming about power and domination, political authority, economic power, affluence. You know what I'm saying? Whatever it might take to accomplish the Reconstructionist vision of the Dominionists, who said, you know, we need to be about reclaiming what we lost in the Garden of Eden. And for whatever reason, it didn't then and it doesn't now appear that those people understood that when they're talking about the dominion we had in the Garden of Eden, it wasn't a legal taskmaster, but it was more of a caring overseer. I mean, Adam and Eve were given a privilege, an opportunity. They weren't given a billy club by God. At least that's certainly not the way that I read. The kind of authority that they were given in the Garden of Eden would have been reflective of the kind of authority that Jesus Christ had when he took upon himself a pastoral kind of authority where he could care for the things that had been created by God. But in any case, nobody seemed to care about that in the 80s. I shouldn't say nobody, but what caught on what caught on was the Dominionist dogma. And when Ronald Reagan won the 1980 presidential election by a landslide, and by the way, I voted for Reagan, and I loved him, and I loved a great deal of his policy, and I wish we had a great deal of his policy right now over what we have.
Mm-hmm.
But when he did, because of his willingness to invoke the name of God and things like that that the church, you know, had not seen in any president in modern time before him,
mm-hmm.
When that happened, it happened on the heels of some of the more prominent today Dominionists who were just coming to their own. I mean, they were just coming to power. And by then, you know, the rising stars included Pat Robertson and,
mm-hmm.
and Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell, and that's how we got on this last week because of Jerry Falwell's name being used. But Jerry Falwell formed the Moral Majority with those people that were involved with him, and those guys went right out, and they started saying that the Reagan victory was their victory.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to their donors, and I mean, there was, you know, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on literature that went out into the mail, and they were literally taking Reagan, one side of Reagan, and sending out information to all the little Dominionists out there that were supporting them, and saying that, man, you know, look, God has given us the victory, and now we have to seize the opportunity to take over the world, starting with the United States, you know,
yeah.
The courts and legislation and Congress, and because God has he has saw the our labor, and he has given us this victory, and now everybody needs to get on board because obviously this is the will of God. And I remember it because I was pastoring, receiving all of that material,
mm-hmm.
and frankly, at that time, I was more with those early Dominionists than I was against them because I hadn't yet come to understand what now I believe to be some of the fallacy of the whole idea. And brother, I mean, Christians bought it by the tens of millions because the preachers wrapped it in the right use of Scripture, and they made it sound so good, and they made it sound so right. But I'll tell you, as a senior pastor of one of the larger churches on the West Coast, I watched what happened. I mean, over time, you know, as a guy who was voted in as a presbyter and working with a lot of other pastors who were coming to me for leadership, I watched how their Wednesday night prayer meetings gave way to fundraisers for local political lobbyists who would come into the churches, and they were promising that together we're going to retake America for Christ. And, man, that became the theme, you know, Sunday morning revivalists. They weren't invited anymore. Suddenly, everything that was old school was being displaced by politicians who were being invited to come in on Sunday morning and speak to the congregation about what the believers could do to participate in the legislative process. Now that we understand that the second coming of Christ is being held up in anticipation, you know, of us dumb believers who somehow had missed in the New Testament example that we were supposed to be about establishing God's kingdom here on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of
course... Yeah, I thought Jesus said something about the kingdom being inside of us and not something that we voted into a particular office.
Yeah, inside of us, but we need to get it out and get it in office
The Dominionist theory. Okay, I missed that part of part of the gospel there. It almost seems to me, and see what you think of this analogy, it almost strikes me as being like the activity of the behavior of the Christians in the times of Constantine, who suddenly have access to the halls of power and just went nuts with it. Is that a valid comparison, do you think?
Absolutely, and yeah, I mean, you know, there's not much new in history, and history tends to repeat itself,
mm-hmm.
and right now, if the neocons in the White House are the political version of foreign policy, which could be the precursor to an antichrist global police state system, then Dominionism is the religious side of it. It's the religious system on which the false prophet can write in to support the anti-Christian system. But we can talk about that a little bit later. But
right, yeah, I'll get to that in a few minutes. But you're right. There's a lot of there. it really is interesting, though, that this process is facilitated by believers who want to see what they believe are Christian morals being enforced in the government system that we have here, while ignoring things, and they facilitate this by ignoring things such as, say, Nancy Reagan consulting an astrologer when she made out Ronald's calendar every day.
Yeah, that's right. But look, there was a lot of pressure, to join the movement early on by all of us pastors who were involved. And you know, people, there's a lot of fallacies in human nature, and one of them is that we want to be associated with success,
mm-hmm.
and we want to be accepted by the people who we believe to be successful. And when all of a sudden the big mouthpieces were heralding, you know, what was going on with the, and I think they, you know, to some extent, they just used the election of Ronald Reagan for their own benefit. He may have benefited, too, from the Christian vote. I'm sure he did, but Reagan continued to be popular with everybody, including atheists, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you know, that was the turning point, and that's why I referred to it, is because the Kingdom Age teaching was being taught, but it wasn't until Reagan came in that, man, all of a sudden and almost overnight, things changed, and people latched on to this presidential election and the willingness of Ronald Reagan to refer to God and Christ and quote the Bible and all those things. And so now all of a sudden we were entering into a new age, a new dispensation, a new revelation from God to his church concerning his will for his people. And at first, you know, because I was pastoring and I've also always had this side interest in politics, you know, I joined those voices for a short while. I was the keynote speaker at some of their local political rallies. But like I said on the Q Files the other night, the very last Trinity Broadcasting Crusade that we did in my church, Family Worship Center, Carlton Pearson was there, Dwight Thompson was there. We raised tens of thousands of dollars for Dwight Thompson, and I remember when I was driving Dwight back to the airport and him telling me how he was going to use that money to win several cities for God. You know, I never did hear any more after he flew out of town, but maybe he did, I don't know. But you know, Nancy Harmon was there. She filmed her love special for Trinity Broadcasting that week. But shortly after that, and I mean literally just within maybe a month, just something inside me. It didn't feel right. It didn't sound right. Maybe it went back to my upbringing, you know, my grandmother being a Methodist. And I, you know, coming up from maybe more, and the Methodists back then, by the way, weren't anything like they are today either.
Right, yeah.
But you know, I said Methodist, I mean Mennonite. And just these older, more pastoral type congregations where you didn't really wear your religion on your sleeve and your Christianity wasn't measured by how high you jumped or how far you rolled or whether you laughed in the spirit or you had any of them other things. It really had more to do with your integrity. I know my granddad was Abe Lincoln, honest, and you never had to have a contract with him. If he told you he was going to do something, he would do it to his own hurt. He would never, ever go against his word. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, right.
These were old ethics that I grew up under.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly something about the superficiality of a lot of the entertainment side of what I was in and some of the stuff behind the scenes that I was witnessing too. I mean, a lot of it just really started feeling wrong to me. And I began questioning a lot of it. And so then here I was, you know, I'm pastoring Family Worship Center, and I come along, and I start becoming the cog in the wheel you know, by questioning. First, privately, behind closed doors. As I'm talking to you right now, I remember some of those meetings where I'm sitting behind closed doors and there's 10 or 15 people, and these are power brokers in Christianity. And I'm saying to them, really? I mean, really? Is this really where we want to go? Because I have some problems with some of this stuff. I think we're getting off track. I think we're abandoning Christ. I think we're attaching ourselves to apostasy. Mm-hmm. I think we're opening the door for Christians to have a justification for abandoning the disciplines of true New Testament Christianity and selling out cheaply by feeling that they somehow can be justified by pulling a voting lever the right way. I just have a feeling that the kingdom of God is not made of the kind of material that we're selling here. And I'll tell you, it didn't make me very popular. I was a keynote speaker at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and it was the last time. The last time, because I got up and I dared to actually mention a book written by Pat Robertson, and I dared to actually say, I fear this is opening the door for the development of a system that's going to lead to the implementation of the Antichrist. Well, you could have heard a pin drop.
I'll bet.
A whole lot of shouting going on that night.
I'll bet.
But I truly believed it. And, of course, you know, that night I was well prepared. And, I mean, I was articulate. I didn't sound like the Oki I am right now. I was convincing, at least in my own mind, you know. And you have to understand, Derek, I was and I still am friends with some of those people. Dr. James Kennedy, who has been a leader in D.C. among the politically enthused evangelicals now for some time. In fact, some writers say that he's probably, behind the scenes, he's probably the most powerful man in Christianity today. But he wrote a long personal letter to me just a few years ago, you know, on official church letterhead, by the way, from his church, and thanking me for accurately reflecting his viewpoints when I would speak in public. And he wrote an endorsement for my second book, The Gods Who Walk Among Us. I never asked him to do that. I never even talked to him about it. And it just kind of came from out of the blue. But Kennedy, of course, was considered by most reporters to be the architect of Justice Sunday last year. And the stated purpose, you know, of all of that, and everybody who's part of it, Focus on the Family and everybody else, is to educate people of faith as to how the judiciary impacts society, and how activist judges, for the most part, are, in their opinion, anti-Christian, and therefore we need to make sure that we get these people out of courts, or when they retire, we replace them with the right people, so that the judiciary, as you started this broadcast saying, can either implement or enforce or support law and rules that go to the biblical ethics, or at least biblical ethics as they are defined by dominionists, which many times you and I would probably agree with, and maybe sometimes we wouldn't.
Right. Well, Tom, I think that's a good point there. We want to take a break here. We want to continue this idea and also get a little bit more of your thoughts on why you call this an evangelical heresy. And we'll do that when we continue our interview with Tom Horn tomorrow on PID Radio.
Well, that takes us to the end of part one, but don't despair. We've got parts two and three coming up tomorrow and on Thursday. And, you know, before we get too far and we end up closing the show out today, Derek and I, the last few days, have neglected to thank Remnant Radio.
Yes.
They've been broadcasting our archived shows.
Yes. Paul Pilgrim at Remnant Radio, the Remnant Radio Network, was kind enough. He picked up our program when we did the short-lived program on Republic Broadcasting on Saturday evenings. And I called him when we had made the decision to discontinue the Saturday night program. But he asked if it would be okay if he could take our archives and start broadcasting them during the afternoon. So if you don't get enough of us on the podcast, you can tune into the Remnant Radio Network, which is remnantradionetwork.com.
Remnantradio.com. ORG.
RemnantRadio.org. Thank you.
And there's a link on the right-hand column on the PID radio site.
Yeah.
I put it there today.
Excellent. And you can listen every afternoon between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Central Time. Of course, that's GMT minus 6. And again, we've been remiss in not thanking Paul sooner. So Paul Pilgrim, the general manager and cook and chief bottle washer there at Remnant Radio Network, thank you very much for carrying the program. And he's got a great lineup there. He's got us on following Colonel Bo Greitz.
That is amazing to me because, you know what, he's a legend.
Yeah, he is. And he also, Paul Pilgrim, also has Visigoths from the Grassy Knoll on the Remnant Radio.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, we're in good company there. So we're just very honored to be part of the Remnant Radio Network.
We are.
So thank you, Paul, and thank you for listening. If you have comments or questions, our email address, as always, radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And you can join the forum at peeringintodarkness.com/forum. But also I wanted to thank some people. We've gotten a few emails about our little Java.
Oh yeah.
And I just want to give you an update. She's doing fine. In fact, she I think she can clean Murphy's clock.
Well, she's trying.
Almost.
She's trying. She jumped on Murphy the other day, and Murphy kicked out. He was on his back, and he kicked out with his legs, and he literally threw Java about 3 feet across the floor.
He did it again today. I was taking pictures of them as they were battling today.
It's like
pro dog
wrestling.
She just went flying up into the air, did a little somersault, came down, just shook her head, and went right back at him.
Well, he feels good because he's got a pack again, and he's got a job again because his job is to tell her when it's time to go outside, come inside, take a nap, eat, and that's what he did for the old gals when they were here, and now he's happy because he's got a job again.
He did, you know, and she pays attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she does. But anyway, we blabbed enough. This is Sharon Gilbert, and you are...
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone.